The captain gazed at the rocky inlet across the bay. With his sextant and his chronometer, he had mapped thousands of miles of this magnificent coastline. The diplomatic part of the mission was interesting, yet frustrating, but this is what he had truly made the voyage for. With each angular measurement from the sea's horizon, he had the powerful realization that he was mapping the globe. As the small boat rocked with the waves, his eye caught the sight of a magnificent mountain peeking out from behind a bank of clouds. He thought to himself as he smiled, "This is what I was born to do."
Virtuous Men, a podcast devoted to sharing the lives of men of history, fiction, and today, and the virtues they personify. In this season, we will explore six crucial virtues of life and tell two different stories for each virtue. Though each story is very different from the other, we will come to understand the truth that the same virtue is often attained through different paths. Welcome to episode 6, The Exploration of George Vancouver. A virtue is a behavior one conforms to in order to achieve a moral and ethically principled life through action. A virtuous man is one who is well aware of how he falls short, yet chooses not to allow his flaws to define him as he seeks to better himself. Such men show that it is possible to overcome the things that keep us from achieving our destinies. Though each man is flawed and imperfect, it is in the lives of flawed men that we see the possibility for virtue in our own lives. This episode's virtue is exploration. Exploration is the act of traveling to an unknown land in order to investigate its terrain, resources, and benefits to humanity. The explorer's spirit is something many of us have felt ourselves, the need to search out the unknown and to see the previously unseen. Exploration isn't always thought of as virtuous, but it becomes a virtuous act when it is taken on as something that will benefit others. Many of history's explorers did this, from Lewis and Clark to Armstrong and Aldrin. In this episode, we will tell the story of a man who greatly influenced the Pacific Northwest of America and Canada through his survey work in these areas. Though he is often overlooked compared to other great explorers, his influence in the region is undeniable.
The Age of Discovery, as we now call it, changed the course of world history. It began with Columbus, who sailed across the Atlantic to land on the shores of the Caribbean in 1492. Over the next 300 years, much of the unknown world would be mapped and explored by Europeans from Spain, Portugal, England, the Netherlands, and France. Coinciding with the Age of Sail, vast expanses of ocean could now be crossed, something considered impossible before. The primary purposes for transoceanic travel were trade and colonization, and these possibilities inevitably led to numerous wars between the various European powers vying for these unclaimed lands. By 1763, at the end of the French and Indian War, the British had severely curtailed French influence in North America and had consolidated much of the East Coast in Canada for themselves. Just 12 years later, the Revolutionary War suddenly introduced another player into the game of carving up North America. With the United States now a major player in the region, after its victory in 1783, there was now a mad rush to explore and claim the remainder of the continent before the other superpowers did so for themselves. This is the world in which George Vancouver was born into. He was born in 1757 in King's Lynn, England, near the Norfolk coast. Growing up on the English East Coast gave young George a passion for the sea, and this led him to join the Royal Navy at the tender age of 13. Though this seems inconceivably young to us today, in the mid-1700s it was not unusual for boys as young as 11 to enlist. His father was a well-known and respected man with good connections, and this led to Vancouver being accepted aboard Captain James Cook's second voyage in 1772 as a midshipman. The job of a midshipman was to keep watch, run the ship's boats, and to participate in navigation training every day. After 5 years, and after reaching the age of 19, a midshipman was eligible to take the examination for promotion to lieutenant. The purpose of the voyage, which was commissioned by the British government, was to circumnavigate the globe as far south as possible to discover if the fabled Great Southern Subantarctic landmass truly existed. Terra Australis, as it was called, was a huge continent thought to be south of Australia and New Zealand. Antarctica wouldn't be discovered by explorers for another 48 years, so the possibility of a huge uninhabited continent was a mouth-watering possibility. The men were the first to dip below the Antarctic Circle, and penetrated as far south as 70 degrees 10 minutes south latitude. Cook then led the men on a series of sweeps across the Pacific and back, between New Zealand and South America, proving that no large continent existed in the temperate climates. This experience was vital for young Vancouver, who learned navigation skills from expert mariners. Vancouver was invited on Cook's third voyage in 1776, and earned promotion to senior midshipman. This voyage would be as ambitious as one could imagine, sailing from Plymouth south around the Cape of Good Hope to New Zealand and then up through the Hawaiian Islands. They then attempted to find the Northwest Passage, and en route to the Bering Strait, Vancouver saw for the first time the west coast of North America. The men landed on a large island off the coast that would one day bear Vancouver's name. After being defeated by the Arctic ice pack, they returned to the Hawaiian Islands for winter. Cook's ability to foster good relations with the native population and with traders and explorers from other nations was an inspiration to Vancouver. He had become somewhat of a protege of Cook's during the voyage, but he was about to learn a lesson he would never forget. Cook had become increasingly disgruntled with his men as they made their way north towards the Arctic. The reasons are unknown, but it may have been due to the stomach ailments he was having, or simply because the trip was not going according to plan. His temper and retribution had been growing, including flogging his men for the slightest infraction and brutally punishing native theft of their camp. The men landed on the shores of the Hawaiian Islands again on January 17, 1779. Cook was initially greeted warmly, even being greeted as an incarnate Polynesian god by some natives. Their stay was generally peaceful, and after a month they set sail again. But just after leaving, the foremast on one of Cook's ships broke, and they were forced to return to shore for repairs. This was unexpected to the natives, and tensions grew as they considered the British to have overstayed their welcome. When the natives stole one of Cook's small paddle boats, he and his men went back ashore to take hostage the king of Hawaii, Kalaniopuu. But the king's warriors sensed what the men were up to, and pursued them. As Cook turned and ran for his life, he was struck in the head by one of the warriors, then set upon by dozens more. He was stabbed to death on the beaches of Kealakekua Bay. Four British Marines were also killed in the melee. Charles Clerke took over command of the voyage, but he was dying of tuberculosis. Nonetheless, he led the men on another pass through the Bering Strait, in search of the Northwest Passage without success. After they landed on the Russian coast, Clerke succumbed to his illness, and command transferred to George Gore and James King, who successfully led the men on the long journey home to England. They arrived in Plymouth on October 4th, 1780, to a subdued homecoming, given the news of the deaths suffered during the voyage. They had been gone for over 4 years. Vancouver had learned much from Cook, both what to do and what not to do. The two voyages had been a natural learning environment for him, and the apprenticeship of a lifetime. He was now a very proficient seaman, navigator, surveyor, and cartographer, and he was just 23 years old. But apart from Cook, he had no major influential contacts to put his name ahead of the queue of the other promising young seamen looking for promotion. To his credit, though, he wasted no time and passed the examination to become a commissioned lieutenant 2 weeks after returning to England. By late 1780, the American Revolutionary War had been raging for over 5 years. Vancouver knew that his position as a Navy officer would only improve once he had proven himself in battle. With Spain and France joining the American cause, this left the Royal Navy fighting three navies, significantly stretching its vast yet limited resources. But opportunities were abundant to prove oneself, and on December 9th, 1780, Vancouver joined the HMS Martin. Over the next year, he sailed aboard the 14-gun ship, performing escort duties in the English Channel and North Sea. In February of 1782, under the command of Captain William Merrick, Vancouver sailed to the Caribbean and was deployed to help the HMS Invincible perform escort duties for merchant ships into Jamaica. He was based in the Caribbean for the next several years. After an informal peace was declared, effectively bringing the Revolutionary War to an end, in April of 1783, Vancouver departed home for Plymouth again. Upon his arrival, he was laid off and given half pay. With the war over, his services were no longer required, and the British government was horribly in debt after 8 years of war fought over 3,000 miles from the British mainland. Vancouver remained in England for the next year, awaiting his next assignment. By early 1786, he received his orders to Jamaica under the command of Commodore Sir Alan Gardner. Gardner became a major influence on Vancouver's career, and also a close friend. Another man who helped move his career forward was Captain James Vachon. A third man who assisted Vancouver was Joseph Whidbey, a naval engineer who would become his sailing master. After orders came from London to undertake surveys of the local harbours and the waters in their vicinity, Whidbey joined Vancouver and the two men carried out the orders to great success. His time in Jamaica aboard the HMS Europa had proven invaluable for Vancouver's career. He had not just gained valuable surveying, cartography, and sailing experience. He was now a first lieutenant, with several key contacts who could gain him sought-after commands. He had forged bonds of friendship with a group of men he could now call upon in future: Joseph Whidbey, Peter Puget, and Joseph Baker, to name a few. What was left now was for his superiors to notice his exceptional skills and experience, and to find a voyage fit for them. And in 1790, this came to fruition. Thanks to the various professional and personal relationships he had built in the Caribbean, and due to his previous experience exploring the North American Pacific coast with James Cook, Vancouver was selected by the British Navy to lead an important expedition to explore both sides of the Pacific coast. He was ordered to sail with a dual purpose. Firstly, he was to represent the British Empire in negotiations with the Spanish at Nootka Sound in present-day British Columbia. The Sound was subject to an increasingly bitter territorial dispute between the two colonial powers, and it threatened to erupt into full-blown war, something the British could ill afford. Secondly, he was commissioned to survey the southwest coast of Australia, the Pacific Islands, and the northwest coast of North America. The latter was Vancouver's true skill and passion. He and his crew of 100 set off on their ship, the Discovery, in December of 1790. Alongside them was their escort ship, the Chatham, commanded by Lieutenant W.R. Broughton, with a crew of 45 men. Vancouver had a good feeling about the crew upon their departure. "I had great reason to be satisfied with these arrangements. The second and third lieutenants, and the matter of the Discovery, whom I had the honour of being allowed to name for this service, had all served some years with me." They departed Falmouth, England, and headed for Tenerife to obtain provisions for the trip across the Atlantic. They then headed south towards the Cape of Good Hope. After their stay in South Africa, replacements had to be found for the few deserters, but the ship left on the 17th of August, bound for Australia. They landed on the southwest coast, near present-day Perth, on the 29th of September. Vancouver named the place King George III Sound. They surveyed the south coast of the continent while sailing east, finally landing in New Zealand at Dusky Sound in November to resupply and to botanize and take astronomical observations. The voyage was beset by storms while in New Zealand. During our previous stay here, in 1773, we had no gale of wind comparable to the point of violence to that which we had lately experienced. This was my fifth visit to New Zealand, and although I have seen much boisterous and tempestuous weather, I never before contended with such a violent storm. After departing New Zealand, the men headed for Tahiti, and then decided to winter on the Hawaiian Islands, known then as the Sandwich Islands. In March of 1792, the men departed Hawaii and continued across the Pacific to Cape Mendocino, 300 miles north of San Francisco. From here, they pointed their ships northward and began an intricate survey of the rugged Pacific coast of North America. What became of this was the most accurate and detailed map of its time of the entire west coast of North America. It also proved, without doubt, the absence of the Northwest Passage through the continent. This was a decade before Lewis and Clark charted a course westward across the continent to the Pacific coast, and the maps from Vancouver were used by the two captains once they entered the Pacific Northwest. Due to the geography of the northern Pacific coast, the surveying was performed using small boats. Vancouver and his survey team sailed and paddled over 10,000 miles, exploring and mapping each and every navigable inlet they came across. The men entered a large waterway separating two large bodies of land known as the Strait of Juan de Fuca on the 29th of April, 1792. The strait was, and still is, named for a Greek explorer who sailed under the Spanish flag and discovered the inlet 200 years earlier. The crew spent the next month surveying what Vancouver would call the Puget Sound, named after one of his trusted officers, Peter Puget. They explored the sound's intricate geography of bays, inlets, rivers, and large islands. During this time, Vancouver laid eyes on Mount Baker, named after British Third Lieutenant Joseph Baker. A very high, conspicuous, craggy mountain presented itself towering above the clouds as low down as they would allow it to be visible. It was covered in snow, and south of it, as a long ridge of very rugged snowy mountains, which seemed to stretch to a considerable distance. On May 7th, Vancouver spotted a giant peak to the south. The country continued to exhibit between us and the eastern snowy range the same luxuriant appearance, the round snowy mountain, now forming its southern extremity, and which, after my friend Rear Admiral Rainier, I distinguished by the name of Mount Rainier. Vancouver, on a later exploration of the Puget Sound in 1792, spotted and named Mount St. Helens and Mount Hood. Throughout the summer months of June and July, the men explored Puget Sound more, visiting Birch Bay and Whidbey Island, which Vancouver named as well. Vancouver then met up with his Spanish counterpart, Juan Francisco de la Bodega y Cuadra, to discuss the outcomes from the 1790 Nootka Convention. Though the men were cordial towards each other, they could not reach an agreement on the claims to these lands and agreed to meet later in the year in California. The men journeyed south to meet with the Spanish, but it was again unfruitful. They then returned to Hawaii for the winter. The survey work continued throughout the winter, and Vancouver's map of the Hawaiian Islands was the first accurate map to be produced. In May, the men turned northward again and reached Fritz High Sound on the 26th. From here, they continued their extensive surveying of the Canadian west coast, making their way towards the southern tip of Alaska. They made it as far north as Afflick Canal, at 56 degrees north, before heading back south in September. For the winter of 1794, Vancouver once again returned to Hawaii. It had now been 15 years since Vancouver had been a witness to Cook's murder by the natives. and learning from this tragedy, he elected to avoid coming ashore at Kealakekua Bay. Vancouver did, however, manage to meet with the tribal leadership of the Owyhee people. Over long discussions, Vancouver and his men managed to convince the leadership that it was in their best interest to come under the protection of the British Empire. After all, the various native tribes had long battled for supremacy over the Hawaiian Islands, and these people were at war with the powerful Maui tribe. During a meeting aboard the Discovery on the 25th of February, the King of Hawaii officially ceded the island to the British and acknowledged his people as British subjects. There was rejoicing on both sides, but during a moment of reflection afterwards, Vancouver noted in his journal, "Whether the surrender of the island will ever be attended with any additional happiness to its people, time alone must determine." Vancouver had a concern and empathy for the native people he encountered on his voyages, something that was very rare for his time. His intuition was correct, and in fact, the British government never actually acted on the news of the secession of the islands after 1794. Tribal wars persisted until 1810 as a result. But what this diplomacy did do was perhaps prevent further intrusion by other European powers. The special relationship between Kamehameha, ruler of the Kingdom of Hawaii, was known among the mariners of the Pacific, and foreigners always took into account the potential wrath of the Royal Navy when dealing with the Hawaiian natives. Vancouver tried but ultimately failed to deliver national peace to Hawaii, but what he did do was deliver international peace. This special relationship is evident even today, as the flag of Hawaii still bears the Union Jack in its upper left corner. The men departed Hawaii for the final time on March 15, 1794, and returned to finish what they had started in Alaska. They continued their surveying of the southeast arm of Alaska and investigated both the native tribes and the presence of Russian fur trappers and mariners in the area. This excerpt of Vancouver's journal gives a glimpse of the confusing nature of the land claims at the time, especially for explorers. Speaking of his encounter with a few Russian traders, he said, "They seem to use every endeavor to impress us with an idea that the American continent and adjacent lands, as far to the eastward as the meridian of Kay's Island, belonged exclusively to the Russian Empire." Making their way back south, they arrived again at Nootka Sound in August 1794. Unfortunately, no orders had arrived from either the Spanish or British governments that would allow Vancouver and his Spanish counterpart, Brigadier General José Manuel de Alava, to resolve the territorial dispute. This did not, however, dissuade the men from cooperating on a joint exploration of the area. This again highlighted Vancouver's ability to find common ground with those who some might call his enemy. Departing south for the final time, the men spent Christmas 1794 at sea before stopping at the Galapagos Islands for provisions. They spent the next 7 months making their way down the west coast of South America, around Cape Horn, with a rendezvous in St. Helena, off the coast of Africa. Not 2 decades later, this island would become the place of exile for one Napoleon Bonaparte. Rounding Cape Horn during the winter in the southern hemisphere was hazardous, but Vancouver took the time to search and disprove the existence of an island in the area. "Considering that we were now sufficiently advanced to the southward to avoid any inconvenience or interruption from the islands which lay off Cape Horn, I determined to shape such a course to the northeastward as might afford me an opportunity of seeing and determining the situation of the Isla Grande." Making it to St. Helena and restoring their provisions, it was now a straight shot home to England. Upon their arrival, Vancouver reflected, "From the 15th of December in the year 1790 to this 13th day of September 1795, 4 years, 8 months, and 29 days, we had lost out of our complement of 100 men, 5 men from the Discovery, which produced in me infinite regret. But when I adverted to the very dangerous service to which we had been so long employed, and the many perilous situations from which we had providentially been extricated, I offered up my unfeigning thanks to the great disposer of all human events, for the protection which thus, in his unbounded wisdom and goodness, he has been pleased to vouchsafe unto us, and which had now happily restored us to our country, our families, and our friends. Upon his return to England, he was knighted by the king, and today the city of Vancouver in Canada and the enormous island off its coast are named after him. His death in 1798, at the age of 40, sadly ended any chance for further exploration. Exploration is the act of traveling to an unknown land in order to investigate its terrain, resources, and benefits to humanity. Apart from his extensive surveying of the area, Vancouver's greatest contribution to the Pacific Northwest region has to be his naming of some 75 landmarks, most of which still bear the names he gave to them to this day. These include Mount Baker, Mount Rainier, Mount St. Helens, Port Townsend, Hood Canal, Whidbey Island, Deception Pass, and Vashon Island. Though he came into contact with Russian, Spanish, and American mariners and explorers, and numerous native tribes, there were no major outbreaks of violence during the 56-month-long expedition. This speaks highly to Vancouver's skills as a negotiator and diplomat, especially given the fate of his mentor, Cook, in 1779. It was clear that Vancouver learned from this tragic event, something that marks a great leader. Vancouver's legacy is that of an adventurous explorer and of an expert cartographer. His maps were invaluable to subsequent expeditions, and the accuracy of his work is still admired to this day. Though his untimely death cut short his Navy career, his example continues to inspire explorers to this day, and even those in our modern day, to seek out wild, unmapped regions of the world, and to do so with respect for what and whom we might find there.
This episode of Virtuous Men was written and recorded by Jamie Adams and edited by Scott Einig. The details of this episode were sourced from Vancouver's biography, A Voyage of Discovery to the North Pacific Ocean and Round the World. If you enjoyed this episode, give us a rating and leave a review in the comments section. Find us at virtuous_men on Instagram and virtuousmenpod on X. You can also watch and subscribe on YouTube at Virtuous Men Podcast. Tune in next time for part one of our season 5 Loose and Unscripted, where we'll discuss episodes 1 through 6 and give a preview of what's to come in part 2 of season 5.